Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews, and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture, and urban design. Hello and welcome to the Green Room. I'm joined today by Graham Duxbury, Chief Executive of Groundwork UK. Hi, Graham.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks for coming. So Graham, Groundwork's a fantastic organisation. Can you tell us a little bit about its purpose and values?
Absolutely, yeah. So Groundwork is a charity helping people to improve, I guess, the physical and social fabric of their neighbourhoods, the places where they live. I say a charity, more accurately, I should say Groundwork is 15 charities. So I run the one that's national in scope, and our job is to support and promote the other 14, all of which operate in a particular part of the UK. And I guess what we're constantly trying to do is put some professional expertise at the service of and at the disposal of local communities so that they can improve the fabric of their areas for themselves, so that we can kind of stimulate that community volunteering to help people make change in a way that makes sense to them. And I guess one of the values that underpins that is that people know most about the place where they live. They generally have a huge amount of kind of pride in the place that they live, even the places that, you know, others may label as disadvantaged or left behind or deprived or neglected. People that live there generally have a huge sense of pride, a huge attachment to the local area, and generally know how to improve it. So our job, I guess, is to stand behind and stand alongside those people and give them the tools and the capacity, the encouragement and support to get on and do what they want to do.
How many projects do you tend to have annually going throughout the 14 charities, roughly? Is it tens, hundreds?
The count that we did last year was about 6,000.
Wow.
Going on at right. any one time. These kind of really kind of vary from very small scale individual initiatives in a particular part of a town through to quite large national programs. So there's quite a lot going through the organization at any one time. You know, some have a defined start, middle and end, may last 6 months, may last a year. Some of them are going on for years in a particular place.
And I understand Groundwork celebrating a significant birthday of 40 years this year. Have the purpose and values of Groundwork remained the same as 40 years ago? Or has it changed or evolved? Has it stayed the same?
I think some of the fundamental principles have stayed the same. Obviously, the approach has evolved quite a lot, if nothing else, in terms of graphic design. I just happen to have here a little archive document.
Oh, wow.
So this is a page of the St. Helens Star from 1982. July 1982, which was the point at which Groundwork was formally launched to the public. And we launched as Operation Groundwork, kind of growing out of an idea called the Urban Fringe Experiment, which was around as an idea in the 70s. And it was all about recognizing the fact that there were kind of, you know, areas of the country that were coming to terms with a changed industrial legacy, really. So coal mines closing down, steel plants closing down. So, you know, some communities, especially overspill estates on the edge of kind of large towns and cities, really feeling the impact of that in terms of degraded landscapes, blackened landscapes, high levels of unemployment, high levels of social unrest. And quite a lot of the time, these places were butting open countryside and farmland. So this kind of urban fringe issues were being thought about, and Groundwork grew out of a bit of thinking about, well, can you take a concerted effort and work with the community and work with other stakeholders in those areas, the local businesses, the local landowners, schools, employers, and try and find solutions to some of those issues. So trying to address, you know, the physical fabric of the places, but at the same time trying to help people acquire the skills and the confidence in order to go on and kind of find solutions. So there was quite an interesting influence coming in from the side, from the international development movement, kind of learning from Oxfam and people like that, who were switching their approach in the 70s and early 80s towards that kind of, how do you support capacity building in communities in order for them to work their way to a better future? So all of those influences and the first stirrings of environmental consciousness, so Jonathan Porritt and Friends of the Earth were kind of around at the time. That network was building in the UK. So out of all of those kind of came this connection between the addressing the social issues, doing something practical about the environmental quality those areas, but doing that in a way that supports a kind of economic change as well. So the three-legged stool of sustainable development, the social, economic, and the environmental, they were there at the beginning.
Which is so intertwined, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's still what drives us now. So these days we talk about the three elements of what we do in terms of creating better places. So still, you know, doing stuff on the ground, making a change to landscapes, better prospects. So the kind of education and skills element of what we do. And then we talk about greener behaviours. So this could be anything from kind of, you know, healthier lifestyles, lots of food growing and cooking and eating classes, that kind of stuff, but also less wasteful behaviors. So thinking about, you know, waste and recycling and energy efficiency and water efficiency. And when you get all of those things happening at once in the same place, it's beautiful to behold. They all kind of do reference each other and they kind of reinforce each other.
Reinforce each other, yes.
So wherever possible, we try and make all of that stuff happen in the same place at the same time.
You talked about 6,000 projects at one time, which is still amazing. And you've got 14 individual charities throughout the UK. How does Groundwork support local communities? I understand the three-legged approach. What does that look like in reality?
I mean, Groundwork has about 1,100, 1,200 people working for it around the UK. And it's those kind of professional disciplines that we use to support community action. So we employ people that know about landscape design. We employ people who know about education. We employ employment support professionals. We employ sustainability experts and advisors. We employ lots of community workers and lots of youth workers. So it's effectively about creating programs and drawing in the funding for those programs that we can then, as I say, work alongside local community organizations or provide a service into those local communities that improves the quality of life in some way. And it will look different in most places. So that's always about responding to what the need is in that area, thinking about where we can add value in amongst the mix of other organizations that might be operating in an area, and making sure that, you know, we've got the expertise that really matters in terms of making a difference.
And so do the local communities really contact Groundwork for help, or will Groundwork spot opportunities where you can have the most impact?
It will work both ways. So in some areas, we've managed to sustain a long-term presence. We may be running a community center or a community garden, you know, at a place in like Kettering. There's a place called the Green Patch on the edge of a housing estate in Kettering, which has been there quite a long time. We've been running it quite a long time. It just acts as a hub for a whole range of different kind of services and activities. And there's a community allotment down there where, you know, groups can come along and learn to grow. There's lots of other volunteering sessions that happen from that one place. So we're a kind of known quantity, a very visible quantity in that local area. In other occasions, you know, we might be invited in because we can help join some dots somewhere, or because we can bring some funding into play and we can stimulate something, we can make something happen. So quite a lot of the time, you know, our job can be described as being like a bit of glue or almost a translation agency.
Or facilitator, yeah.
Facilitator, absolutely. So we're constantly kind of negotiating conversations between groups of residents who may want to do something and the local authority that may have a plan for the local area, or local businesses that have some kind of development going on in a local area. And somehow those competing sometimes and sometimes conflicting interests need to be aligned and brought together so that a kind of, you know, a more consensual plan can be taken forward for that local area. So sometimes we're kind of brought in for that kind of brokering, facilitating, mediating, conflict resolving kind of capability. In other cases, you know, we're just a presence and we talk to people a lot and we know what needs doing, and people come to us with ideas and we work together to try and make that work.
Graham, over the last 40 years, the mission, purpose and the values of Groundwork have remained the same. And I think everyone listening to this is very tied and invested to those values, and we all believe in them. Do you feel that government has kind of become more involved or interested in the positive results of the activities of Groundwork? And do you see, you know, the ideal outcome is that Groundwork still continues to be involved, but our government or our state actually rolls out a number of these initiatives itself without needing Groundwork always?
You know, Groundwork's been working alongside government, both national government and local government, since day one. To one degree or another, you know, we were brought into existence because of government support at both levels, national government and local government. So at the time, the Environment Minister was Michael Heseltine. And he certainly saw groundwork as an idea that could help remedy some of the things he saw when he did his famous kind of coach tour of Liverpool in the early 80s after the Toxteth riots. So we were one of the ideas on a piece of paper that he said, oh, that could do some good in this part of the world. So I'll sign that one off. And then we've always had very strong support from local authorities over those 40 years. So the kind of ideas that we deal with and the delivery that we're involved in has been and always will be of interest to public sector stakeholders. Absolutely. And we've been in and out of every iteration of regeneration policy or welfare to work policy over the last 40 years. You know, there's countless new deals come and gone and single regeneration budgets and national strategies for neighbourhood renewal and lots of other stuff, urban task forces, et cetera, et cetera. So we've kind of, you know, been in and around all of those all the way through. And, you know, the imagination and the level of resource that government has put into this space over the 40 years has obviously waxed and waned with different administrations. But one of the things that we can definitely point to in terms of our own history is that governments of every shade can see something relevant in what we're talking about and have been generally supportive of what we're trying to achieve. It's just their support comes in different forms depending on the nature of the administration. I think where we are now, you know, levelling up white paper, not many people can kind of fault that in terms of what it says and its analysis and its aspiration and kind of very joined up picture that it paints of what needs to make a difference. Likewise, the Environment Act and the 25-year environment plan, again, generally a very positive, supportive government document. The challenge that I think we and others in this space have got at the moment is just the degree to which they are being enacted and delivered and resourced appropriately. But we do need to think it's not all about central government. There's a lot of kind of focus on what central government will not do, but there's a lot of scope to make decisions and to take action at a regional or local level. There's more devolution in the system than we've had, even though there's not as much as lots of people would like. But, you know, devolved mayors and devolved assemblies can get on and do some stuff without waiting for central government. So all of that, you know, potentially is quite positive. You just need to look at the work that is going on in Greater Manchester, supported by Professor Sir Michael Marmot, who's the kind of, you know, country's leading authority on health inequalities and the wider determinants of health. And he's doing some really interesting work with Greater Manchester about what can actually be done to address health inequalities. Very big on, you know, the connection between climate change, green space and green infrastructure and people's health. So, you know, you can get stuff done irrespective of a political vacuum like the one we've got at the moment. But the bigger picture is government needs to play its part. Local government needs to play its part. Organisations like us need to play our part. And the part that we need to play is supporting local level community action in order to address some of these really big issues.
Yes. And that's, as you say, a devolution means that you can keep acting even if there is a vacuum at a national level. We had a great response to the Queen's speech, actually, and how you'd like to see more ambition in the Levelling Up and Regeneration Bill, right? Bringing people and nature back to our streets. And if I can quote you, you said, bringing life back to our high streets is good news, but to truly level up, we need to be more ambitious about bringing people and nature back to our town and city centres. We should be thinking big about potential to design communities in a way that supports social connections and ensures everyone has good quality access to nature near to where they live. How can the landscape architecture community help with this? Think bigger, because I think you know your message was obviously at the bill, but there's a wider community of people who are at work here.
There is, and you know, and the challenges we're talking about how you reduce inequality in the country and how you know prepare for and mitigate the worst impacts of climate change. These are whole system issues, and everybody needs to, you know, do their jobs differently and live their lives differently if we're going to kind of address all of those things. So you're absolutely right. The landscape profession has a part to play in all of that, as we all do. So I think where Groundwork has always specialised is in seeing the connections between different agendas, because we've got this kind of, you know, 360 degree social, economic, environmental viewpoint on things. It's always about kind of understanding where one bit of the jigsaw might connect with another bit of the jigsaw. And the other thing that we're always also about is partnership. So, you know, we recognise that we've got some things to contribute here, but we can't solve these issues on our own. So it's all about how you work with those partners in an area in order to bring a wider set of tools into play. So I think in terms of the landscape profession, those connections are between, you know, the stuff that we need to do around climate change, around net zero, around biodiversity, and then connecting that across with the fact that we know climate change impacts first and worst on those who have least and least choice in society. We also know that there's a kind of social gradient in terms of access to good quality environments, in that those that would benefit most from the restorative impact of nature are those who are least likely to be able to access it, either because they're living in a more disadvantaged area where there's just less access to good quality environments, or because they're more prone to the kind of harmful impacts of climate change, whether that's flooding or whether it's extreme heat, as we know all about. So it's that kind of doing design with that social purpose in mind, doing design with that environmental imperative in mind, and embedding both of those principles into every landscape, into every bit of green infrastructure, making those kind of design solutions and making those spaces work as hard as they possibly can to deliver both on the kind of access and inclusivity agenda and on the climate and biodiversity agenda. That's what I mean, I think, by the level of ambition.
And do you think that in terms of inclusivity, we do enough at the moment in terms of inclusivity of various groups or demographics? There are sections of society or groups of society that still aren't included, or can you give examples where that's been widened?
Yeah, I mean, there absolutely are still sections of society who are not benefiting as much as they have a right to from the landscapes that we're all kind of designing and managing and making use of. That said, this debate has come an awfully long way in the last few years. So, you know, everybody's now talking about it. It's just about what are the solutions and how do we kind of systemically change things for the better. So I think everybody's cottoned on to the fact that, you know, many of the landscapes that we're talking about, especially if you're in the kind of urban parks agenda, as groundwork is often, you know, these were designed by Victorians. Leisure pursuits that Victorians enjoyed at the time, and probably only a certain strata of Victorian society had any kind of say in how those places were designed. So there's quite a kind of long backlog and legacy of stuff to work through before those spaces can be reimagined in order that they provide all the kind of benefits and amenities and opportunities that our current society demands of those spaces. You know, there's only so many of them, we know. There's only so much resource to do work in these places. So it's all about designers, and I know an increasing number of designers are doing this, thinking quite radically, what are these spaces for now, irrespective of what they were? And we know that in many places we need to retain heritage features because people are attached to heritage features, and that's good. And we don't want to stop doing that. But it's also thinking about, well, is using this space at the moment, and who isn't using this space at the moment, and why they're not using this space at the moment. So many people listening to this will be following, like I am, the huge success of the Make Space for Girls campaign, which has just highlighted this single issue, but it's a really important issue. You know, why does use of those spaces drop off for teenage girls? What's going on there? Why can't we reimagine, repurpose spaces so that teenage girls feel comfortable in them and know that there's stuff for them to do, and know that there's a point in going to them? I mean, we run lots of surveys with young people. We do a lot of work with young people. And the most often refrain that you get to those questions about why don't you go to your local park anymore? And the answer is because I don't know what I'm supposed to do there. It's very obvious when you've got a play area for young children what the purpose of that is. And it's very obvious if you're a skateboarder,
yes,
what the purpose of that bit is. But just in terms of, you know, your ability to hang out in a space and
which
feel
is one of the most important
space.
Things for teenagers well,
absolutely
to be able
is.
To do. Yeah.
Absolutely is. And yet, you know, we're still seeing too many designs where, you know, the stuff that teenagers want to do is shoved right down in the corner away from all the houses because residents don't want the noise and the hassle. And yet that's precisely why teenagers won't use it, because they don't feel safe. Because they're in a dark and overgrown corner that no one goes there. And there's a lot of unlearning to do of our traditional modes of thinking around this space. But as I say, I'm really optimistic because there's so many designers, you know, thinking new thoughts and interesting thoughts and being more creative and being more audience focused. So I do think we're getting there.
it's audience engagement and audience focused. And I remember actually we were chatting about this last year and you sent me a great link to this particular campaign for girls. And it was looking at seating designed very much with groups of girls sitting together chatting. And that's what they used the space for. So it was almost kind of swing seats so that there was kind of a feeling of secureness and kind of being able to kind of chat and share together. And that's what they wanted to use the space for, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, and the challenge is, you know, one of the hardest bits of money to secure in any project is the engagement bit. So having those conversations with people, it is a skill or an art, depending on which way you view it, is best done by people who know how to do it. Ideally, is best done if you can support the people themselves to have those conversations with each other.
Right, so they kind of collect those.
The peer research idea of having young people researching needs and wants and uses with other young people and playing that through into different groups and making sure that you're kind of really exhaustive about it. So, you know, you're not just talking to the people who are already in that space. You're going and knocking on doors and you're talking to people who, you know, wouldn't dream of ever going to that place and finding out why they wouldn't, you know, whether it's an issue with dogs, as it often is, or whether it's just a perception that these spaces aren't for me, or whether it's, as I say, the comment back saying, well, I don't know what the point of that place is, and therefore I don't know why I would go there. Then it's having those conversations in order to inform a design.
And is that often a local authority wanting help with doing that?
Well, I mean, you know, in the world that we inhabit, local authorities, you know, are the kind of managers and the guardians of many of these spaces. So absolutely, you know, local authorities are very keen to understand these issues. We know, you know, local authority finances are a big cause of concern, you know, the ability for them to meet all the demands placed on them. That's why we get into lots of arguments about whether parks and green spaces should be a statutory function and so on and so forth, which they're not at the moment. But you could also argue just, you know, making it a statutory function doesn't necessarily do anything to improve the quality of them. So there's a huge issue about, you know, where those resources might come from. And that's why, you know, things like the Levelling Up white paper, what was really interesting and useful about it is that it put pride of place as a kind of big theme within that. And that also is linked to funding can be secured from things like the UK Shared Prosperity Fund, and then you've got the Towns Fund and the Levelling Up Fund. So there are resources in the system, and that's before you start thinking a little bit more laterally about funds in the health system or in the kind of climate adaptation world, where you can start kind of drawing the connections and the threads between these different agendas and say, does that give us access to a resource base that we wouldn't otherwise have had? And to improve the spaces, but crucially, to make sure we're having that conversation with the people who want to use the spaces or aren't using the spaces so that we can understand how those spaces should be planned, designed, maintained, activated, managed, etc.
It would be great to hear some examples of where Groundworks engagement has made a real difference to a community. Can you tell us a few about those, Graham?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I try as often as I can to get out and about and see what's going on the ground. And there is some great stuff happening at the moment. So, you know, recently I was at a place called Rivington, which is a fabulous place, really kind of historic place. It was the seat of Lord Leverhulme, who was, you know, big industrialist in the northwest of England. And, you know, he built this massive, I guess, it was a pleasure palace, I guess. It must have been the Neverland of its day, full of kind of, you know, grottos and Japanese lakes and, you know, strange bridges inspired by something you saw in Africa and so on. It gradually kind of fell into disuse and disrepair, but he was very clear that he wanted local people to be able to access that place. So the Rivington Terraced Gardens, as they were known, you know, with some money from the Heritage Lottery Fund, we in the Rivington Heritage Trust have been able to revive that place. You know, we can't turn it back into the magnificent palace with its sprung dance floor that it was whenever, but it's such a kind of really interesting, magical place. You know, volunteers working with us have uncovered secret footpaths all the way up and down these terrace gardens, and the kind of combination of these ruins in the middle of this wonderful natural landscape is a fabulous thing. It doesn't look designed at all. It looks kind of really, really natural. But that's one of the interesting things about, you know, the way things are designed at the moment. It's designed with nature, designed for nature, almost kind of imperceptible, not knowing that there's been the hand of a landscape architect somewhere in the the background there. So that was a really fabulous one. But then we can go to other extremes, kind of really, you know, simple, straightforward stuff as a program we're running in Bradford called Better Place Bradford, which is about working with diverse communities in Bradford, especially families with young children, just helping to make very small improvements to green spaces and greenways in and around Bradford, and then using that as a way of introducing those communities to those spaces so that they can make better use of them and they're more likely to go there, and having urban rangers that can kind of facilitate that journey around those green spaces.
Helping them understand how to, what's the best way to interact with it. Yes.
So mapping the places that there are that they might not know about, helping them interact with those places, and then pointing out where there's a kind of connecting footpath here that will take you into the open countryside or out onto the moors. So gradually helping that kind of journey of exploration. And then some other really simple stuff, which again is the kind of stuff you wouldn't think about necessarily because it's so simple. It's a program that we're doing with Balfour Beatty, who are supporting us through fundraising to effectively design and plant green screens around school playgrounds, which are next to busy main roads, then measuring and monitoring the kind of air pollution before and after inside those playgrounds. So really very, very simple landscape work, but absolutely transformational in terms of the ability of children to play safely in their own school playground away from air pollution. But there's countless more that if you were going to ask me what my favourite ever groundwork project is, I'd have to talk about Park Penalta, which is near Caerphilly. And when you're thinking about how do you measure the impact of this kind of stuff, you know, that was classic kind of old colliery, disused, rundown, black landscape, and with some kind of millennium money at the time. So we're going back 20 years or so now. That's become a kind of wonderful community park. If you're in that part of South Wales, not too far from Caerphilly, then it's a great place to go. And what really sticks in my mind is it's got a huge kind of earth sculpture of a pit pony, designing consultation and conjunction with the people that used to work in the mine and their families. So it's a beautiful kind of amphitheatre in the shape of a pit pony called Sultan, which, you know, you can explore and have events in. But I do remember seeing the kind of the way in which that was unveiled or inaugurated. They remembered when the mine shut down in the local area, the kind of miners marched out in ceremonial fashion with the pit banners ahead of them. And when they opened the community park, some of those same miners walked back in with the same banners and with a lump of coal that became the pit pony's eye. And you think, you know, that wouldn't come across in any analysis of data around the success or impact of that project. But the effect that it had on people in that area, that wider community, the families of those people that lost their jobs in the mine, et cetera, et cetera. And now it just creates this beautiful natural resource.
Absolutely.
You know, that's what I mean by this, you know, the stories sometimes are much more valuable than the numbers.
And it feels much more theirs than if something had just been sort of decided and put down there. They're completely involved in the evolution of that project. Oh, I love that. And you're so animated when you talk about these examples. It's clearly one of the pieces that you enjoy the most. Do you get to visit a lot of these projects?
Not half as often as I would have liked. So it's been one of my New Year's resolutions this year to try and do that a little bit more now that we can get around and about.
Yes.
A bit more. You know, I read a lot of reports and I speak to a lot of people inside our network who tell me these fabulous stories, but there's no substitute for actually being there and talking to the volunteers and, you know, seeing what's been done.
But the stories are important because it's what communicates the success of the projects. Yeah.
Mm.
With some of the projects that have been going on for a number of years, or the engagements that have been going in for a number of years, you know, what's a successful groundwork engagement, and do you measure the impact of it on a community, and what does that look like?
We've got lots of measures, some of which get kind of quite technical. And one of our challenges actually as an organisation is because we're involved in lots of different strands of activity, quite a lot of it kind of secured through bidding processes or grant funding processes. They all have their own kind of measurement frameworks attached. And some want to measure the kind of outcome on skills and employability. Some want to measure the outcome on biodiversity. Some want to measure, you know, something else and something else and something else. So the challenge for us really is trying to kind of draw the threads between all of those different approaches to measurement and saying, what do we think actually makes a difference in terms of the delivery that we do? And finding a way of, you know, having a measurement framework that's not too onerous but actually gives us meaningful data that we can use to both improve what we do, to influence the practice of others, and then to, you know, provide a platform for more resources in the future. And we're actually just going through this process again. It seems to be a cycle that happens every 5 to 10 years where you completely revamp your approach to measurement. So data is one thing, but the stuff is just as important and is quite often overlooked. So, you know, it's the stuff you get from more narrative side of your evaluation work. So trying to hear from people that have been involved or that have benefited and hearing about the change that this has brought about to them. So the stories that you might hear about someone who was engaged initially because they and a few of the mums were concerned about a patch of kind of overkempt, neglected space in the middle of a housing estate and decided they wanted to do something about it. Somehow we found our way into that conversation and enabled them to take a lead on doing something. And one of those has now gone on to stand as a counsellor in their local ward. So it's the change you can help bring about in someone's own sense of civic responsibility almost, and their confidence to then go on and front these conversations with other people in their community.
It's like a stepping stone or a leap pad. Yep.
Yeah. Someone finding something that they always had within them, but then having the confidence to articulate that and to become a recognized community leader. We quite often talk about working with community leaders, and community leaders come in all sorts of shapes and sizes and backgrounds, and some people would absolutely bristle at the thought that they were leading anything on their community, but they are kind of genuinely transformational individuals sometimes, but will always have to go on a journey to kind of understand, well, you know, I'm butting my head up against a brick wall here, or have been, you know, why can't we do this in our neighbourhood? Well, it might be because, you know, the council's got a strategic plan that's going in the opposite direction, or the utilities providers say, well, you can't do that on that space because of this. It's that kind of journey of education that you can take people on so that they know how to do it for themselves. That's the best measure of success, when someone turns around and says, we don't need you anymore.
Yes, we now know what we need to look for. We've got our next few projects. We now know where to source the funding. We know how to collect peer feedback and research. For communities that do want to engage with groundwork, how do they or how can they engage with groundwork?
So obviously, we're an organisation that delivers on the ground. We can't be everywhere. We've got projects going on in quite a lot of places, but we're 6,000 not in every
places.
Neighbourhood. not in every neighbourhood, not in every street corner. So a look at our website will give you a sense of kind of where we concentrate our activities and so on and so forth. And if we're not visible and if we're not in an area, the other thing that Groundwork does at a national level is distribute grant funding on behalf of funders. So that's one of the things we can do if we can't help you with our kind of skills and capacity on the ground, because, you know, there isn't a project taking place or there isn't a funding stream that we can work with in order to make something happen. Then you might be able to apply for a grant. You know, we're distributing grants on behalf of Tesco, their community grants program, distributing grants on behalf of Comic Relief, on behalf of central government, on behalf of HS2. So there's quite a lot of kind of grant programs in our mix, and we try and do those in as supportive a fashion as possible so that people can not only easily access the funding, but also through our local network, we can provide a bit of hand-holding support. If people don't know how to apply or they want to make sure their project's going to deliver more effectively than it would have done otherwise. So there's a few different ways in. As ever, we'd love to be able to do more in more places. So if, you know, if people have got thoughts and ideas for how we might get involved, then there's ways and means of talking to us.
Well, Graham, you've been with Groundwork for just over half of its life. Clearly, it's an organisation that you feel very passionately about as well. What is it that drew you to Groundwork and the work that Groundwork does?
It does go all the way back, actually. So I grew up in a place called Darwen, which is just between Blackburn and Bolton. And when I was kind of in my teenage years, I guess, Groundwork was a thing. It was always in the local paper. So I read about it quite a lot. It was always doing lots of stuff, including, you know, in my old school and all that kind of stuff. So I was one of those people that kind of, you know, saw it going on around me. And what always struck me when I was getting a little bit older and thinking about, you know, what I wanted to do with myself, was the fact that it was really very practical. So I, like many people, had those kind of environmental leanings and wanted to do something positive about the world and with my life and so on. But I felt like how refreshing it is to have an organization that's actually making a difference now, as opposed to campaigning for something that might happen in the future or trying to stop something from happening that's going to be harmful. You know, all of those things need to happen. So we need organizations that will lobby for political change. We need organizations that will campaign against, you know, environmental catastrophes and wrong-headed decision making. But I was always drawn to the one that kind of rolls up its sleeves and makes it real for people. So, you know, helping people who would not see themselves as environmentalists become environmentalists, because actually the frame of reference and what we're talking about is it's your street, your neighborhood, your town. You know, what can you do here and now in order to make a difference, knowing that that's part of the jigsaw that we need to put together in order to address the environmental issues that we've got, that kind of local action, but within a kind of, you know, global mindset. So that was the bit that kind of really drew me to the organization. Actually, a humorous story in that I tried to get into the organization in my kind of early career and couldn't find a way in. So I thought, oh, damn, right. And I went off and did some work for somebody else and gradually worked my way back round, found the opening, got myself in, and haven't left since.
Well, I think Groundwork's very fortunate to have you, to have moved all the way through. And so we've talked a little bit about landscape architects, and we've talked a lot about climate change and the climate urgency for climate change. What would you say is one thing that landscape architects could do to help combat climate change right now? Something practical?
So the most practical thing they can do is come and work for us. We, like many organisations, are challenged by recruitment issues. And actually finding landscape architects is one of those biggest challenges that we've got. You know, we've come out of the pandemic, weathered that storm, are building for the future, have got all sorts of exciting plans and projects on the go. And actually the thing that's holding us back at the moment most is the recruitment challenge. You know, trying to think about getting the staff in place in order to deliver all of those projects is the biggest challenge. But that aside, I think the one thing I would say, which, you know, goes back to something we've been talking about, is making sure that that kind of front end engagement within the local community is happening and is happening right. And you can have a conversation with people about climate change without it necessarily being about climate change. So, you know, part of the challenge we know, although I think this is lessening a bit, is that just the conversation about climate change can put people off. And, you know, people find it a bit kind of a bit too difficult to grasp what their role in that might be. I think actually, you know, given the events of the of this year and recent years, I think that's starting to break down. People are beginning to recognize that climate change is here and it's impacting now. You know, despite what some newspapers and commentators would like to tell us, and however much people try to muddy the waters, I think by and large most people are getting it, and the penny's dropping.
You can't get away from the temperatures.
Absolutely. No. This is here and now. And, you know, it's not just affecting people in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa. It's affecting people here. And once you couple that with cost of living crisis and everything else, you get a real sense that there's, you know, a moment we've got to kind of turn into an opportunity, really. If people have switched on to that message, you know, how does that then play out in the way that landscape architects and other professions do their job? So making sure that, you know, we're doing that work in a way that's both kind of carbon literate and biodiversity positive. But the third bit of that is the education bit. So at every step of the way, talking to the people who are going to be involved, going to be benefiting, going to be living around and interacting with the space, and helping them understand why it's done in the way that it's done. So, you know, really another great project that we've been involved in Manchester has become known locally as the Sponge Park in Gorton, because it's effectively a big rain garden. You know, it's about soaking up excess surface water and floodwaters. But community engagement work around that we've been doing in conjunction with the designers has all been about, you know, how do local people understand what's going on there? For them, it's a new green space in the middle of where they live, and that's brilliant. But there's something else going on as well. And that message has managed to get through to people about, well, these kinds of places are really, really important, because they, you know, they're not just good for me to take the kids to go and play, but they're actually performing a function that might mean my house is less likely to be flooded like it was last year and the year before.
That's the wonderful legacy of Groundwork. It's not just the spaces that are created, it's the minds that have been educated to go forward and lead a more environmentally or more environmentally sustainable mindset and outlook on life, which is just brilliant. Just understanding the purpose behind some of these developments. And last question, if you could put a bench anywhere in the world, Graham, where would you put it and why?
I've just seen our family bench go back into its rightful place in the park that I effectively grew up in, called Bullventure Park in Darwin. So a few years ago, we clubbed together and bought a family bench because, you know, my parents lived around that area for a long time, and I take the kids back to visit, and we always go in that park, and my brothers and sisters take their kids in there. So we've got a special Duxbury bench. And then the reason why I'm telling you this story is because there is a significance in these things. That bench disappeared little while ago, and there was general and genuine consternation.
Wow.
about the fate of the bench, the family bench. But it had been taken out to be cleaned and restored.
Oh, but no one told you.
we probably missed a communication along the way. Anyway, and it's now back, and it's a cause for kind of jubilation and rejoicing that you know that bench will be there for another 50 years now. So that's just a little story to share. You know, maybe there is good. The best play for our bench, but if I could have one that was blended fully into the landscape and made of sustainable sources, I'd probably put it somewhere overlooking the Serengeti.
Oh, amazing. Yes. What a beautiful view. Thank you very much, Graham. That's really lovely to talk to you. And thank you for answering our last three questions.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. As always, it's always good to chat.
Thank you. And you, likewise.
Thank you.